This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed.
Sharon Lawson Bram, let's get him a rinky dinky dink.
Yeah.
Let's get a rinky dink.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking whole train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pot. Watch your mouth, you scratchy Canadian.
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I'm just curious.
5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
I made Jesus walk, so never going to hell. Couture level flow was never going on sale. Luxury rap, the Hermes of verses. Sophisticated ignorance, write my curses in cursive. I get it custom. You a customer, you ain't custom to going through customs. You ain't been nowhere, huh? And all the ladies in the house got them showing out. I'm done, I hit you up, man. Nah.
Welcome to Havana. Smoking Cubanos with Castro and Cabana.
Space Speed Nation, welcome to a great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Tuesday evening inside the PTBN studios. And of course, as always, with me is my PIC, Mr. Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 445 of The Gold Standard. We are just over 50. We are 55 episodes away from, yes, five bills. I hadn't mentioned it yet, but...
I can't wait to quietly retire at 500 or something like that.
Yeah, we should just do a tweet. Yeah, we just do a tweet and then go like and, you know, buy a mansion.
We'll review Barely Legal 97 and then just close up shop.
We that one premium, though. We make people pay for that one.
And then we'll tease the trivia tournament and just never come back. And that'll be it. I'm just going to delete everything on social media. Just be gone.
JR, always a pleasure. Happy or belated happy Easter to you, sir.
Yep.
Yeah, happy. Yep, so, and got some eggs for the kids. All right, a little Easter egg hunt for G and Big Al. No.
Yeah, we did.
Some bunnies.
It was a good time. It was like 85 here, so it was a good day to spend outside for Easter. And they got filthy, which is good. They've been especially Alex, you know, my son Alex has been like just like going crazy inside all winter. He's just been dying to get outside, so he's been a dirty mess for like 3 days straight now. But he's loving it. He's loving it. So
you got his Easter haircut on Saturday. Everything looked nice, and then
that was it. Downhill. Yeah, me and him went first thing. It was Friday morning. We went first thing, 7 o'clock to the barber, and he did a good job. He sat there by himself. So that was it.
Good.
Come on, barber buddy. Nice haircut. So you may have heard the giggling in the background, and that is because the third man in our booth is here. He is our Jimmy Jam. No, we're not going to. The Pete's the Jimmy Jam.
No,
Pete's the Jimmy Jam. But the buddy's Jack to our Michael Hayes and
right.
Terry Gordy. And that is, of course, the one and only Kelly Nelson. Kelly, how are you?
I'm doing great.
And, of course.
Good to have you back, sir.
Yeah,
so and
if you're new to the show, Kelly is pretty much our official third man on these MSG house shows that we're going to be covering. We're thrilled to have him here to help fill the air.
Yes.
So,
yes, absolutely. And there'll be not much air to have to fill on this show because this thing's jam-packed, this final soiree in our home office, JR, of 1985. Definitely sets the tone, in my opinion, for what's to come in 1986 in terms of who the hot guys are going to be and you know, what's coming up and that kind of thing. Because the guys that were showcased heavily on this show are guys that are going to be take big steps in 1986. And that includes the champion, actually, too. So sure. why don't we hop right in? The date is the second to last day of the year, December 30th, 1985, from, of course, JRR office, Madison Square Garden in New York City. I'm sure it was a nice brisk week between Christmas and New Year's Day. Maybe a little flurry coming down in Manhattan. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
A sellout. Your attendance 20,225. So the building was packed to the rafters for this one. Your announcers, of course, always Gorilla Monsoon, and sitting next to him on this evening in his nice frilly tuxedo is Lord Alfred Hayes, because the body not there. And in fact, Gorilla mentions it during the first match, which we'll get to in a second. Jesse the Body Ventura not in the building because JR. He was in the other building being occupied by the superstars of the World Wrestling Federation on this evening. And usually it's like some – if you notice most of the years, guys, most of our other dates, usually the other show is in like some shithole in the middle of nowhere. And it's like 300 people or whatever. Not on this day, because while they're jamming the garden, they're at the Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. 14,960, so a packed house.
Big
at the Joe.
This should run December 30th every year. That's packing them in.
Here is your this is good news for us. Well, I'm about to read you some of these names because that means we don't have to talk about them tonight. Pink Tonga defeated Rene Goulet. Ivan Putski defeated Terry Gibbs.
Oh, my man, Terry Gibbs.
We don't see Ivan Putski. Another guy we don't get to see tonight is Pedro Morales. He beat Iron Mike Sharp.
Hey, that's been a good feud in 85 here. We've seen two matches between them. One was pretty good.
So you're wondering where Jesse was. Gorilla says during the first match he's, quote, on other company business, because he's here with a shot at Tito Santana's Intercontinental Championship, and he wins by countout. Interesting.
I'm sorry. Was it Morales and Sharp? No, it was Morales and Goulet. We've seen the feud. I apologize.
Yes. And after seeing some of those, we wish it was Morales and Sharp some night. Ricky Steamboat defeated Don Morocco. Corporal Kirshner defeated Nikolai Volkoff. In the main event, the Junkyard Dog defeated Terry Funk.
Pretty good.
And
guard.
I think they talked about that show. And I think they talk about that match, JR, on our next show.
Yes, they do. Oh, no, they don't. They don't.
No, that's in Denver. Yeah, that's in Denver. Sorry, wrong mm-hmm. D city.
Pretty big. Pretty good night, though. Both cards are pretty stacked with decent matches, and they drew a big crowd. Yep. So this was a strong vacation week for them here.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. JR, fill us in on the rest of the report.
Hulk Hogan is our WWF champion. Excuse me, 707 days into his reign. Tito Santana, 177 days into his reign, is Intercontinental Champion. The Dream Team, 128, is tag champs. And the Fabulous Moolah, 35 days into her reign, as we saw, of course, on our last show when she upended Wendy Richter and drove her out of the promotion as the mysterious spider. Before we get to the notes, Kelly, since you weren't here last episode, did you want to give any thoughts on that spider fiasco? Did you have anything to bring to the table on that one?
Well, I did. I watched the show last week because I like to keep up with you guys, and that was the first time I'd seen that match since whenever I last watched it on Best of the WWF Volume 5, I think it was. So seeing it through, you know, mature eyes, it was interesting. There was a part where Richter's facing the camera. It's after the screw job, and she says something, and if you could read lips, you could pick it up, but you know, I couldn't. But I'm so interested in what she said, because that was after she knew she'd been screwed and it all went down, and yeah, that was cool. What a moment. I guess she just left like straight after that, got in a cab, didn't even change out of her wrestling gear, caught a cab, and never came back. So that was the sad end of Wendy Richter.
She probably said, Moolah, I'm going to go to your house and unlock all the women from your closets that you have hidden in the basement.
Yeah.
I'm going to go save everyone. It was an interesting one for sure. But that'll be it for the Rock and Wrestling Connection. Scott, have you cooled down finally? Are you finally off your
I'm off the Wendy Richter. I'm off the Wendy Richter contact high. Everything's we're all good because we probably won't see any women's matches in 86 either. We had to deal with hillbillies and midgets tonight, so that what a great fucking replacement. So
right, here are the some notes from Mr. Jarvis. What's happened since our last show on November 25th? A couple of years before, WWF would eventually take on Jim Crockett on Thanksgiving. They would take on the AWA in 1985 on Thanksgiving night. November 28th, the Dirty F ran a show in Minneapolis with a near sellout of 15,000 head-to-head against the AWA. The Dirty F ran their show with lots of former AWA talent, with Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage on top and Piper and Orndorff underneath. The AWA countered with a $100,000 battle royal, the Road Warriors versus the Freebirds, and Leon White versus Bill Irwin that drew 12,000 plus. So another strong night here in late 1985 in the Twin Cities in the promotional battle between Dirty F and the AWA. The Land of a Thousand Dances video from the wrestling album aired in its entirety in the November 30th episode of Championship Wrestling. And a point of interest, Hulk Hogan is not in that video. Kelly, any memories of that song? Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's a favorite of mine. I love that whole scene with them all together singing. Yeah, that's a classic. A friend of mine had that tape, the wrestling album on tape. That was how I was able to listen to it back in the early 90s. So yeah,
he wasn't even on the cover of the. Yeah, I mean, he had like an insert or like an inset picture on the cover of the album.
That's right,
Hogan. He's not even in the. I know you said he's not in the video, JR. He's not even on the cover of the album.
Well, the cover's from the video, isn't it? Aren't they all in the studio singing? Isn't that
yeah? You would have figured at least Hogan showed up for that for the picture anyway. But mm-hmm. They do like an inset picture of him.
Yeah, I had the tape too, and it came in like a big. It's almost like the record case, and the tape was in like the bottom right hand corner, so it was like a full. The box for the tape was actually like a full record size thing.
Yeah.
So
it was kind of
cool. Yeah. That's right.
All right. The Dirty F held a memorial event in Charlotte on 12/16 after the passing of Rick McGraw. The card included Hulk Hogan versus King Kong Bundy and Andre the Giant versus Big John Studd. On the 12/21 episode of Championship Wrestling, Roddy Piper's guest of the Piper's Pit was Dr. Thruball. He insisted that Bob Orton's junior arm cast had been on for 9 months could come off, citing it should not take longer than 6 weeks to heal. Additional house show running, we talked about that, so looks like we're good to go.
Yep. Among some of the celebrities you mentioned, JR, on that December 28th card, of course, Jim Brunzel, Mad Dog Vachon. There's a big fuck you right there.
You mean the
put
November 28th?
Put Mad Dog Vachon on this card.
Thanks.
I mean the November 28th one. They were in Minneapolis on December 28th as well. Mad Dog Vachon was there as well. Let me look back real quick and let me see. Because he was at the December show. I wonder if they stuck him on the November show as well. Let's see here. Mid-Hudson Civic Center, November 28th. Minneapolis, yep. Thanksgiving night, AWA in the area. Spivey against Barry O. King Tonga, Alexis Smirnoff. Pedro Steve Lombardi. Jesse Uncle Elmer. Hogan Savage. Bob Orton Putski. Brunzel Gibbs. And the main event was Orndorff Piper. So, yeah, no, pretty solid show. All right. Well, let's head into the home office and get started. As I mentioned, Gorilla and Lord Alfred are your analysts. I don't think we even saw Mean Gene on this evening, so maybe he's finally phasing out the whole garden thing, and he's just kind of doing his thing now on TV hits and that kind of thing.
Maybe it's been off of Christmas. We'll see. Christmas break.
That was part of his contract, yeah. All right, why don't we dive in and take a look at our first match, JR, which... not exactly star versus star, but I thought not a bad combination of guys to open the show in terms of popularity versus, I guess, anonymous heel. What do we have here?
We have Special Delivery Jones is back in the house taking on Ron Shaw. SD was looking kind of bulked up, guys. I don't know if you, if you noticed that. He was looking a little bit bigger than usual. Alfred puts over SD's experience in MSG as compared to Shaw. Gorilla says Jesse's on assignment, and Alfred's filling in, like you mentioned. Scott gets a mat work and counters early on Jones until he ducks his head and eats a big kick to the face. Shaw goes to a chin lock, and the fans are just all over him. Gorilla and Alfred talk about the importance of warming up and breaking a sweat backstage before your match, and chastise Shaw for not doing so. Jones comes back with a body slam, but misses a falling headbutt, which allows Shaw to go back to the chin lock. Jones fights up into a wrist lock, but Shaw yanks him down and goes back to the chin lock. Jones punches free and gets caught with a kick and a knee lift and trapped in another chin lock. Shaw uses the ropes for help and fends off another Jones comeback. Alfred wonders if 1986 will be Shaw's year, given how strong he looks. And Gorilla says he's looked good since his broken leg has healed. Jones battles back with a headbutt and some left hands followed by a big slam for one. SD goes to a chin lock now as Gorilla talks about how the chin lock has increased in popularity as a rest hold for offense and a grinder on defense. Jones kicks Shaw away and goes back to the chin lock, but Jones releases and gets caught with a shoulder block. Shaw follows an elbow drop for two before going back to the chin lock again. Gorilla wonders if any managers are looking into Shaw, and Alfred says they never waste a second. They're always watching and taking notes. SD breaks free and starts to work over the arm as Gorilla puts over Lou Albano. SD keeps hammering away and messes with Shaw a bit before going to the chin lock again. Shaw breaks out and unloads some strikes and biting and tries to find a seam to put SD away, but Shaw runs Jones into the buckle. SD no-sells it, fires up to a pop, and hammers away. Gorilla rips SG for a lazy cover, and Alfred wonders if he's using this as a training session, if he thinks he can beat him at any time. Shaw shoots SD into the ropes and ducks, and SD sprints over and gets a small package for the win. Way too many chin locks. Way, way too many. I thought there's some glimmers in the hair from both guys, and I like the finish, the way SD sprinted across the ring and did the small package. But I thought it was too long here for the open. I thought it felt like they were meandering just to kill the time. And I'm going to give this grade a little bit of generosity because the crowd actually stayed with them, and I like the finish, and a half star is my generous grade, more than a dud. Scott, what did you think of this one here?
This is going to be one of the most bizarre ones
that
we've done.
By the way, that went 1836. I mean, that was
1836. Yeah. I gave it a star and a half. I thought it was. I really liked it. Because, no, I mean, a guy like Ron Shaw, you're like, what the fuck are they giving this guy 18 minutes for? But I mean, I thought it was okay. I thought he was a good. I thought he had some decent heel offense. I will say that SD probably was a little bit less motivated than he should have been for a guy who's opening the show but getting a pretty hefty amount of time to wrestle. But I don't know. I like the pace. I think the commentary is helping me enjoy the matches on this card more because I just love Gorilla and Alfred. I think they have great chemistry. They're very easy to listen to. Very laid back, kind of sing songy a little bit. Nice back and forth banter. I really like this match. I thought Shaw kind of delivered the goods. The chin locks, I don't know. I kind of looked past it. I thought it was a decent walkthrough to open the show. The crowd was into it. I mean, if it sucked that bad, they might have
shit on it. Christmas high. Everyone's off. Everyone's on vacation from school and work and all fired up. New Year's Eve was the next night. They were just happy to be there.
We need some Ron Shaw, damn it. But no, I liked it. I thought it was good. I gave it a star. I gave it a star and a half. How about you, Kelly?
Well, no, not a star and a half. I gave it a half star like JR did. It was about what I expected it to be, an opener at MSG. We've seen quite a few of these, lots of, headlocks as well as chin locks, lots of boring chants. Yeah, there were some bursts of action, but yeah, it was just, yeah, too long. And I mean, the crowd was, they were behind SD, that's for sure. That's why I didn't give it a dud. I mean, at least SD was getting some response, so it wasn't just total crickets. But yeah, not very good. But I don't know, like 1836, it didn't seem like it was that long. I guess that's
no, it didn't.
Plus.
I didn't think it did at all. I mean,
yeah,
it was a little sprint.
I was wondering if it maybe was clipped at some point, but I don't know. It didn't seem like it was almost a 20-minute long match, so that's another point in its favor, I guess. But yeah, it is what it is. Half star.
Every one of those chin locks felt like 20 minutes to me. No, I mean, they just kept going back to it and back to it. Like, if they would have varied that up a little bit, it might have been better. And I did like the finish. I did like SD sprinting over, and I don't know, that was kind of unique. You don't see that often where the guy ducked his head and he, like, ran over and did the small package. I thought that at least was pretty cool, but yeah, otherwise, just all good.
All right, and again, your time was 1836. All right, next up, a match that probably was better than it had any business being, and it's taking the first of two halves of two great tag teams this evening that are being split in half. And what is match one of this two-match series this evening, JR?
It is Jim the Anvil Neidhart taking on B. Brian Blair with his Hazel's Honey Nut Hut. solid second match on paper. Tag team members explode in a singles bout. Anvil's all fired up and cackling. Albano's managing Blair for some reason. Why not? We open with a lockup. I like it just like shows up with these fucking guys. Like, what the hell? Like, another tag team needs a little Albano. I don't know. It just completely comes out of nowhere. It's just odd. So he's out there. And here we go. We open up with a lockup as Alfred puts over both his tag specialists, but notes that the Hearts took longer to gel than the Bees did. Blair gets a crossbody for two, leading to Anvil bailing to regroup. Anvil comes back in and challenges Blair to a test of strength, and then boots Blair in the gut as soon as they lock up. Anvil keeps the knuckles locked, but Blair powers up and kicks away before taking Anvil down, dropping an elbow for two. Anvil bitches out the crowd as Gorilla puts over the tag division. Anvil works a side headlock and then fends off a Blair comeback with a hard shoulder block. Blair charges again and Anvil no-sells the shoulder block attempt. After a crisscross, Blair messes with Anvil and buries him with a dropkick that sends him scurrying to the floor. Back inside, Blair works the arm as Gorilla talks about facial hair. Anvil kept trying to work free, but Blair was able to trip him up and maintain control of the arm every time. Anvil powers his way into control, clubbing away and grabbing a bear hug. Anvil slams Blair to the mat, misses an elbow, and Blair gets a small package for two. Both men collide in the ring, and Anvil comes back with a front chancery. Blair suplexes his way free and kicks and punches away, but Anvil catches him in a rear chin lock to grind him back down. Anvil knocks Blair to the floor, but follows up with a slam on the concrete and then blocks Blair from getting back into the ring. Blair finally makes it back in and runs Anvil through Anvil with a flurry, going to the eyes as payback in the laying and clothesline, followed by an elbow drop off the top rope for two as time expires for a draw. This is fine. The finish was okay. We established that these teams are pretty even, and they wrestle to the to a draw. Decent power stuff with Anvil mixing some solid selling, and I like the comebacks from Blair as well. I went one star here. I thought it was serviceable enough. What'd you think, Kelly?
It was okay. The Albano advising Blair thing is new to me. I had never
it must
heard
be the
of
bees,
that.
Right, altogether.
Right, but he doesn't come out with Brunzell later. True. Is strange. Like, I wasn't watching the TV at this time, so I don't know if he was actually managing them. I think it was just a very, very short-lived thing. It is strange. Very strange. There wasn't a ton of action at the beginning of this one, but I did make the note that Monsoon and Hayes and Scott, you sort of touched on this, how they're so great at just talking, and filling time during meaningless matches that make these, meaningless matches not too bad. Sometimes, and I'll touch on Hayes again later, sometimes it's a little, just going nowhere on Hayes's part. But for the most part, though, they do a really good job. There were some good bumps by Blair, and it did definitely pick up in the last 5 minutes. The crowd got into it. They were really behind Blair's comeback. And yes. I've come to really like Blair in tag matches as the fired up babyface, as the hot tag. He's really good in that spot. Also good at face in peril, actually. Pretty underrated in that role, actually. But when you have these split matches between tag teams, you always kind of just end up thinking, well, I would have rather just saw the tag match. What's the point of the singles matches, because you get like half a tag match, you get a face in peril sequence kind of, or whatever. And you're missing the other half. And they do have a pretty good match coming up in a couple months at MSG. So that's something to look forward to when the Hearts and the Bees
yes.
Get in the ring. It's a classic, actually. I gave this a star and a half. It was the 5 minutes at the end redeemed it completely.
And I think, well, Scott, get your notes, and I want to actually have a quick conversation about Anvil and his improvement since we first saw him. But go ahead, talk about the match, Scott, and we'll get into that conversation.
Improvement? I gave this 4.5 stars. I mean, I thought I'm only kidding. No, I gave it a star and a half. I will say this though, like I think Anvil has definitely improved as the years progressed, and maybe I'm leading into our conversation, JR, because I hated him when he was just kind of floating aimlessly with those weird brown tights or whatever. I feel like he gained some kind of purpose once being a member of the Hart Foundation, because I thought this match was wrestled very well, and I thought two things. Number one, specifically about B. Brian Blair, is that number one, they obviously consider him the power guy of the duo because he wrestles the bigger dude.
Right.
And secondly, you don't see Albano later, so I don't know if B. Brian Blair was the idiot who needed the extra help and Jim Brunzell didn't. I don't know, but I'm done with it. I mean, this is just out of control now. It was Vince's thinking, really, any babyface that needs that extra help, let's just give him to Albano? Like, was he that popular, I guess? I don't know. I thought it made no sense, but
it was odd. And like Kelly said, I forgot that he didn't come out with Brunzelli. It's really weird that they put him with Blair. It's like they just saw him sitting in the back eating a fucking sandwich or something. We're like, go out there with Blair. Add a little extra pop to him or something. It's so weird how he gets assigned with these guys.
Yeah, it's so bizarre because he doesn't come back later. Incidentally, I don't know if you guys knew this or not, but I actually, because anytime we have a time limit draw, I real time the match. Like I bring out my, my I try to time it to see if it's real.
Fucking
do you guys have any
Green
Lantern
fan over here with his stopwatch?
it honestly was not even close. The kayfabe was a 15-minute draw. The match actually went 19:50.
Oh God! Why not just say 20?
I'm sorry, 19:29. It went to 19, so it went an extra 4.5 minutes.
Right? Why not just kayfabe it to a 20-minute draw? That's weird.
I know. So I don't know if Graham typed that wrong or if that's where he found it. I don't know. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, he might have typed it wrong. Because, I mean, I would think he probably meant 20. I mean, they don't say it. Like, they definitely didn't say 15-minute draw.
Yeah.
On the thing, so.
No,
it's also strange. Why would this match only go 15 minutes when the previous match went 18:36?
Right.
Presumably to a 20-minute draw if it went that long. Why would the next match be shaved down to 15-minute?
And it's always 20. It's always 20. I think it's a typo by him. I said it's always. Yeah, I mean, they never do 15-minute draws. It's always 20.
No, it's definitely a typo. But anyway, the actual time is 19:29. I found it weird that I don't know if Neidhart was not comfortable in his tights on this night, but I don't know why he wrestled. And even Gorilla points it out that he's wrestling without the strap things on, like, you know, you could use him as a weapon or whatever. I thought that was weird.
Well, maybe he ate a little bit extra on Christmas, you know, a couple of hams or something. Feeling a little bloated.
It definitely looks like he had a turkey or two from Stu's oven. So
a little extra salt, you know, a little swelled up.
And again, I found it interesting that Blair was they consider Blair the power guy of the Killer Bees, and they put him with Anvil, and we'll see later on, we'll see the other two guys together later. So I thought that was interesting, but then again, they're roughly the same size, Brunzell and Blair anyway. So I don't know, the crowd got into it. I enjoyed it, and this is from a guy who I was trashing Neidhart in like April, May. When he was just kind of the solo guy. I really feel like since going with Jimmy Hart, who, by the way, not here in this evening, you know, and being in this tag team, kind of giving him a purpose, I think has made him a better wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to see better singles, man. And we'll get it again, JR. I know I'm probably leading into the conversation, but I certainly think that Neidhart has definitely gotten better since going into the Hart Foundation and kind of having a purpose to his character. I don't know what your thoughts are. I know we'll lead into that, but. That's kind of what I think about Neidhart. I feel like he's gotten better once he's become like a purpose, like his character has some type of goal instead of just being this random heel thug at the beginning of house shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a poor man's dream team, right? I mean, like, as far as the improvement he's shown, like, we always talk about, oh, Beefcake really improved by working with Greg Valentine on the road and, you know, picking his brain and, you know, and I think the same thing's probably happened, even though Brett and Anvil kind of came up together and Brett's not really much more of a veteran, he is much more just succinct and crisp in the ring. And I think just by osmosis, Anvil's probably learned how to work alongside him and just improved as the weeks and weeks have gone on. And Blair's really good. I mean, like Kelly mentioned, like I think it's a good pairing for him because it's the guy who can really sell and work comebacks nicely too. And Anvil just had to club him around and you work the bear hug and cut off his comeback. So, I think it was a good pairing for Neidhart. I definitely think he's improved. He's come a long way since those early ones that we saw out of him. What do you think, Kelly? You think there's been improvement here in 85?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert on like pre-Hart Foundation Jim Neidhart, but I think what you said is true. Yeah, he's learning from Brett. Fast-paced tag team matches that can make you improve. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to that for sure.
Right, yeah, he definitely, as the year progressed, he definitely kind of found a focus with his character and actually I think it's made his in-ring work better. So we get a draw, a 15 plus 4.5, but I'm sure it's a typo. It's it probably was supposed to be a 20-minute draw and they fell short by 31
seconds. Graham right now. Tommy's an idiot.
Well, somebody would probably correct him. So
20-minute draw. Fucking cheat.
All right. Next up, JR, kind of a fresh, I believe this is a debut here. I believe we have a debut here against a guy who we wish would be leaving.
We saw this guy last month. So how could you forget? Fucking disaster.
Oh, that's true, That is true, That's right. Well, this is definitely better, even though he's facing a guy who we wish would retire, never come back. what do we got?
We have Jose Luis Rivera taking on Hercules, who, yes, we did see last month in that disaster against Cousin Jr.
That's right. I forgot about that.
We renamed the fucking worst match. Worst match
that's
after
true,
that.
Yeah. Did you watch, to forget it. But
you watched that one, Kelly? How bad was that match?
Yeah, it was pretty bad, for sure. But, I mean, there was a sea of bad matches on that card.
Yes,
I guess that one won by a hair, for sure.
So Herc is back this month. We're hoping things go better. Alfred dissects his attire, including the Lederhosen vehicle that he's wearing. Thought that was an interesting description. Al also talks about seeing Herc in Miami a couple years ago, and he saw that talent buried inside of him and knew he'd be a star. Herc works the arm off the bell, but Rivera breaks free and gets a flurry before Herc cuts him down. Al says Rivera's lacking a killer instinct, and that's what holds him back. Hercules levels Rivera with a back elbow and hot shots him across the top rope. Herc drops an elbow and covers, but picks him up at two and stomps away as Blassie just laughs. Herc chokes and kicks away and then knocks Rivera to the floor. Herc follows out and slings him into the guardrail and suplexes him back in. Hercules hits an atomic drop and cracks him with a forearm, but again picks up Jose at two. Gorilla demands the referee to stop the match to prevent further damage, but Jose Luis comes up punching and lands a dropkick. Rivera ducks on a whip and Herc slugs him back down in the back of the head. Herc press slams Jose Luis hard to the mat and then locks him in the backbreak for the win. I thought Herc looked way better here than a month ago. I don't know if it's just nerves or if it's just Junior was that fucking bad or what, but he looked much improved. Jose Luis was serviceable in selling, but God, he looked awful. Much better power squash this time around. I went half a star, and Rivera is just like, I mean, just dead in the water, Scott. I'm just going nowhere fast.
I gave this one star because I just thought, Hercules was just a great, this was just a glorified power squash. I loved it. He just absolutely murdered him. And it's just, Jose Luis Rivera just looks pathetic. Like, he just looks like a loser. Like most babyface jobbers kind of have like a little pep in their step before they get sent to the gallows. Not Rivera. He's just like, hey, I have this jacket. Hey, here I am.
He just speaks loser. Like, he just looks
throwaway,
like
a throwaway wave. The crowd boos him. I mean, I think he got just as many boos as Hercules did.
Yeah.
And secondly, literally gorilla right out of his mouth. Lordship, I don't think he's got much of a chance tonight. He even buries him before the match, before the bell even rings, he buries him. It's so pathetic. Yeah, he's just a scrub. I'm sure we'll see him a little bit more. I wish we didn't, but he wrestled like a boss, and I actually think he got a couple of like face pops when the match ended. I mean, nothing crazy, but for MSG 85 standards, he got a couple of claps and a cheer or two when he finished the squash. I mean, I thought it was an efficient beatdown. And he was really torquing him on the backbreaker. I mean, Rivera was like bent like a right angle practically.
No, it was night and day for Hercules for sure. He looked way better. Like just a month later, it looks way better.
Exactly. So
I'm fine blaming Junior.
We'll give Jose Luis Rivera a little bit of credit here for at least kind of going with the flow and taking the beating like a man. Unlike Junior is a big, you know, slovenly, disgusting mess. I gave it a star. Great squash by Hercules, complete with the brown knee pads to go with his outfit, which Gorilla mentioned. And, I thought it was a good kind of reboot for Herc after that shit show in November. So I gave it a star. What do you think, Kelly?
Hercules did look good. He's got a great look. But I want to talk about Jose Luis Rivera. So this
is so dramatic. Oh, Hercules is bigger than everything. But I want to talk about Jose Luis Rivera.
Yeah, well, this is something I've been working on kind of for years because Rivera was part of Titans of Wrestling. Lots of jobber matches for him, lots of squashes. So I'm quite familiar with him. And while watching this last night, it just occurred to me that, you know, Jose Luis Rivera in 1985 was perhaps, you know, the most pathetic man in wrestling history. Just it finally, you know, hit me while he's going through like an almost 10-minute long squash. And I was just thinking, why does that have to be so long? Like, the poor guy loses on TV every week, usually in, you know, 2 minutes or less. Why does he have to do these super long squashes on house shows? Remember a few months ago, he had a even longer squash against Randy Savage, one that I think was like 16, 17 minutes. And it's just so sad. I mean, it's bad enough that he has to lose on TV every week, but he has to go on the road and do these epic long squashes. You know, he had 30 seconds, not even 30 seconds of offense. And that was meant to total silence. Like, the fans have seen him for so many years. He's been in the territory since 1982, and they just know he's a total loser. And they won't even give him a token applause for his comeback. He's just not even worth that. He reminds me of You know, the character Gil on The Simpsons?
Yes.
Like the failed salesman.
And just knows that's it. Jose. Just knows what a failure he is. I mean, he's definitely getting cuckolded at home. I mean, there's no doubt about it. His wife is banging the fucking pool boy. And he knows it. He's like sitting on his computer. Well, I guess there's a computer. He's sitting reading the newspaper in the other room while she's just banging the pool boy. And, you know, there's nothing he can do about it. He's just so pathetic.
Yeah. Well, probably one of the other wrestlers. I think Johnny Rods is going to have his wife. Or something.
Give it to the Johnny Rods.
Because I've watched a lot of Johnny Rods matches. That became like an interest of mine to find like the best Johnny Rods match. And most of the time he lost. Like almost every match I saw of Johnny Rods, he lost. But guess who he beat? Jose Luis Rivera.
He's his bitch. Yeah. He's his bitch. He owns his wife and him.
Yeah. So Rivera, just sad. Like it just hit me after years of watching Rivera last night. Like this was just a sad, pathetic individual. Half star for the match. Half star.
The question is, where is he now? How come WWE.com won't do a "Where are they now, Jose Luis Rivera"? It's kind of like wondering where, you know, Paul Christie is, or I don't know. You know, one guy, Kelly, who was a huge Jose Luis Rivera fan, was Johnny Sorrows. He probably has a Jose Luis Rivera T-shirt.
The only one in existence.
Yeah, hey, man, you know, I love Rivera. He's awesome.
I think he was more of an Estrada guy than Rivera.
I loved that match.
I loved that match. All right.
Oh, boy.
Next up, another... let's get off him. Let's get on to this, because this was fascinating and a lot of fun to watch. Because we see the... blossoming of a new character. That's a great,
the bosoming.
A great way to put it. The blossoming of the bosom of a character here, JR. Lead us in. What do we got?
We have Lanny Poffo taking on adorable, yes, adorable, Adrian Adonis.
What?
Alfred is excited to see this new adorable look for Adonis. He says Gorilla has told him about it, and he's excited to see it. Poffo passes out frisbees and recites a poem before the bout, so that's kicked off now for Lanny, the poet laureate. Adonis is rocking his black tights, but his hair is more puffed out, and he has purple scarves and gift bows all over him as a Christmas thing. Gorilla compares him to Gorgeous George as he preens around the ring and jaws with the fans. Gets some early stalling as Adonis takes his time, taking off the scarves and preening while Poffo paces and flips around. Gorilla wonders if Jesse Ventura would be open to teaming with Adonis now, in his current state. Poffo works the arm and tosses Adonis around with arm drags as Gorilla says Adonis has come out of the closet. I didn't realize this. Kelly, do you know like that they said that? I mean, I couldn't tell if Gorilla was kidding or if that was like part of the storyline. Like he blatantly just says he's come out.
Right. No, I forgot about it, but you know, it's true that they did always say that. But at the time it was, you know, you didn't even think twice about it, but yeah, they totally always said that he was coming out of the closet or came out of the closet. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. Did you know that, Scott, that they said that?
I absolutely didn't. That was going to be one of my things I was going to mention. Mm-hmm. I mean, cause he says it in an interview. What did he say it on TNT? Like, I don't know what.
Yeah,
I don't know.
He just says,
really
as a matter
weird.
Of factly, which was good, you know, for 1985, I thought it would be, like, a lot worse. Like, he says, like, oh, he came out of the closet. And, like he's perfectly normal about it. When I thought, like, for 1985, Gorilla would have been, like, just burying him for it or something, you know, because it just wasn't the style of the WWF at this point to have any tact about things like this in any way. So it shocked me when he was just so cavalier about it.
I know. It's
in
so
a good
weird.
Way. So Lanny,
but they always treated it. Sorry, they always treated it like it was just he started wearing pink.
Right.
Like that was what coming out of the closet meant. There was nothing homosexual about it. It was just he's wearing kind of, you know, feminine clothing now. That was their idea of coming out of the closet. Basically.
Right. So more like a whatever transvestite, more than anything else.
Yeah. More like that. Yeah.
1985. Lanny grabs an abdominal stretch and goes back to the arm as Gorilla says, Adrian, put on 40 pounds. So, again, this guy must weigh 700 pounds. He puts on 40 every time Gorilla sees him. Alfred said that was done to add power behind his bulldog finisher. And Gorilla says Adrian has noted he could lose the weight any time, and because it hasn't slowed him up yet, he hasn't. Poffo nails Adrian with a dropkick and then gets super close near fall by dodging a charge and getting a sunset flip. Adonis misses a charge in the corner. Poffo gets a splash off the middle rope for two. Adrian then dodges a springboard senton to grab control. Adonis pitches Lanny to the floor and keeps working him over when he climbs back in. Lanny sneaks in a pair of near falls on cradles and comes at Adrian with a flurry of right hands. Adrian dodges a charge in the corner and gets the bulldog for the win. A fun match, I thought. Good psychology in this new gimmick by Adonis. Strong offense by Poffo with a good finish. Adonis continues to be the highlight of a lot of these shows. I went a star and a half on this. And I would have liked to see it longer. I would have taken some of that 40 minutes in those two openers and put it on here. This only goes 9 minutes. I was actually enjoying it, and Adonis has really still been one of my kind of hidden finds. Now, man, I hadn't told everyone. For me, he was. Just how good he's been watching all these. Kelly, what'd you think?
Yeah, I like this one, too. It was cool to see basically the debut of adorable Adrian Adonis. No pink tights yet, but he's got the bleach blonde hair. Poffo had a very lukewarm response, like scattered boos even. So he's already got the taint of being a jobber on him, unfortunately. Because he's actually, in 1985 and into 1986, he was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And a very good babyface, actually, as we see in this match, because he got the crowd on his side eventually. Adonis bumped like a madman as usual, and that helped Poffo get over. And he was getting good near falls on Adonis. There was the sunset flip out of the corner that was really close. The moonsault that he hit was another good near fall. Like, the crowd was actually gasping. Adonis waited till like the last second to kick out.
That was a really good near fall. I feel like that's one of the best near falls we've seen on any of these shows this year.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just a little thing like that that makes such a huge difference in a match. So yeah, both these guys were doing really well. It was short, yeah. But the finish was cool. That bulldog was awesome. Yes. He really spiked his ass.
So that extra weight. You put it on, yeah. So you could really bury that bulldog.
Yeah. Great bulldog. Yeah, I thought this was a good little sprint, and I gave it 2 stars.
What do you think, Scott?
I gave it a star and a half. The interesting thing here was, 2 points we've already talked about. Obviously, the premiere of the adorable one. And secondly, I mean, like I said, there was no guessing. It's like, he was Adrian Adonis, and now he's come out. You know, it's like, I don't know, he should have come out to like Diana Ross's music or something. It was really weird. And then they were like, all right, whatever, move on. But the one thing I liked about this match that I won't like about Adonis as much moving forward is he was still wrestling like Adrian Adonis
right here,
like Murdoch tag team partner. He didn't get all like his moveset didn't get all weird and effeminate for a few months. But this match, he still is kind of wrestling as like old school grizzled Adrian.
Yeah.
Which I think is awesome. Sadly, as I said, as we progress into 1986, it's going to change. He's going to be flowery and dopey. So I took pleasure in watching this match, knowing that, you know, the last vestiges of the real good Adrian Adonis was still there, and it'll change as time progresses. I feel like, obviously the dying hair, but I feel like he kind of slapped together that outfit like immediately, like, all right, here, grab a scarf and throw some of these fucking things in, like the Paramount Theater had some other like gift wrapping symposium or something. I just steal some bows and throw them on myself. I don't know, it's weird. As for Poffo, interesting point, Kelly, because it does seem like people have realized, wow, Lanny Poffo, he's just going to keep fucking losing like Jose Luis Rivera. Who cares? He's just got more charisma and, you know, gives away free gifts to some of the fans. So that's probably the only thing he's got going for him in that aspect. But at 9:02, I mean, decent length match. Probably could have gone a couple more minutes and I'd have been fine with it. And again, I gave it a star and a half. I thought it was solid enough, and I liked that Adonis has this new persona, but for this match at least, he still wrestled like the old Adrian, which is what I really appreciated. So, Mr. Adonis, the adorable one we call him now, gets the victory. All right, before we get to our mid-show main event here, we got some backstage interviews to dive into as Gorilla goes backstage, and he goes backstage with?
First, he's chatting with John Studd. Studd puts himself over, says he's chasing Hulk Hogan around the country and is close to catching him. After his stepping stone match tonight, Studd says he still hasn't been slammed and has a $15,000 prize out there for anyone that can do it. Of course, he's being a little bit delusional. He has been slammed, but whatever. Gorilla then chats with Jim Brunzel, who's sporting a beard. Brunzel agrees that he has a tough night ahead and puts over the strength of the Hitman. Gorilla talks about how these single matches came about, and Brunzel says the beard is lucky as he hasn't lost a match since he started growing it. Gorilla then talks to Johnny V and the Dream Team about their defense against the Hillbilly Contingency tonight, as Gorilla says. Made me laugh. V predicts a quick and crippling victory. Gorilla talks about Beefcake injuring Hillbilly, but Beefcake said that launched Jim's career and made him into a star. So, there you go.
Okay. And from there, we go to our mid-match main event, and the World Wrestling Federation Championships on the line. And JR, the first chapter of what would be a years-long saga for these two men.
And that is Randy Savage challenging Hulk Hogan for the WWF Championship here to close out 1985. And he's been around for, what, 6 months? And we said it from day one, how he came off as a star. He's presented as a star, and he started calling out Hogan right away. And here we go. I mean, they wasted no time putting him in this match, you know, in a big spot on a big card. This is a big show for them. Close out the year. They've really filled it up. And Savage is the guy that gets the title match. And we saw that in that, you know, Minneapolis show as well. So he's had a big month. Won the wrestle or came in the finals of Wrestling Classic. So they've really put the, you know, put the metal down, put the pedal down to the metal here over the last month or so for him. So he gets his demanded title match with Hogan after shooting up the ladder. Quality opponent for Hogan, too. But the risk, of course, in this, guys, is that Savage is someone that can show him up, I thought. So, I mean, this was it was a little bit risky with Hogan because, yes, he is super over. But Savage has been awesome. And he's a guy that can possibly make Hogan, you know, work circles around him in the ring, something we haven't seen a ton of with Hogan as far as opponents goes. And someone that's super, super cool and has a great look as well. So it's a little risky. Savage absolutely is a star, no doubt about it. Again, we see that in his entrance. Hogan's now using Real American now that the U.S. Express is pretty much dissipated. And he's decked out in red and yellow and comes up to a mega pop. Some good stalling early as Savage taunts Hogan with posing and playing to the crowd. Hogan shows off his power right away, chucking Savage off a tie-up and blowing a kiss to Liz to a roar. Hogan uses his power further as Savage is starting to realize just how good Hogan is. I thought that was kind of a cool thread throughout the match. You see Savage, he's been calling him and talking shit for months, and then as this early portion goes, like, you can tell Savage is like, oh shit, this guy maybe is pretty good.
Yeah.
So I thought that was cool, kind of facial expressions and the way Savage was acting. Savage bails, Hogan follows, but Randy dodges him and chucks a chair in the ring. Al says that's a stupid move, a waste of time. Savage gets back inside and Hulk grabs the arm, but Macho goes right to the eyes and gets to work. Hogan dodges a leap and Savage crashes into the ropes, allowing Hulk to hammer away and bury the challenger with a clothesline. Hogan gets an atomic drop to send Savage to the floor, where he uses Liz as a shield. Savage heads back in, catches Hogan in the gut, and then tries a high cross body, but Hogan catches him and drops him with a backbreaker, again sending him outside, where he uses Liz as a shield once more. Savage is able to distract Hogan and clobber him with a clubbing blow to the back of the head. Savage pitches the champ outside and cracks him with a double axe handle from the top rope. Back inside, Savage works Hogan over with some quick strikes, but Hogan keeps shaking them off and then hulks up and fires away with right hands and a clothesline. Hogan levels Savage with a big boot that sends him back to the floor. Liz steps in front of her man, but Hogan moves her out of the way and throws Savage inside. Savage catches Hogan with a desperation boot, but Hulk drops his head and followed that up with a big elbow drop for two, a really close two. Hogan pops up and goes for a clothesline, but Savage ducks and the referee eats the blow. Savage knocks Hogan to the floor and grabs the belt and then leaps off the top and clobbers him on the back of the head with it. Savage drags the ref to his feet and helps him count Hogan out on the floor, giving Savage the win. Savage goes outside and grabs the belt. And Gorilla calls him out, saying Al, and Al says Macho lost his cool and it cost him the title. Savage puts the belt on and walks around the ring as Fink makes an announcement, but then reminds everyone that Hogan is still the champ. The crowd pops big when Fink says that, and Savage just levels the ref and then carries Liz and the belt down the aisle and leaves. The bloodied Hogan chases him down and drags him back to the ring and pummels him and takes his belt back as the crowd goes wild. Savage finally escapes and Hogan poses to close out the match, this half of the show. Super fun sprint ball. No elongated heat segment, just lots of anger and fighting. I thought the finish made Savage look a little dumb in some ways, but it was smart because it protected everyone. I thought both guys looked like stars. I thought Hogan looked awesome. He matched Savage's pace, worked in a way that made Savage realize Hogan's better than he thought. You know, my comments earlier about being worried that Savage could show him up, I thought Hogan maybe took that to heart as well and really worked his ass off to keep up with him and show that he was on equal footing in the ring. Great start to a feud and a fun match to end the year. I went 3 stars in this, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, this is amazing. I gave it, let's see, I lost my place. I gave it 3.5. It was awesome. I think Hogan needed to be challenged. Not just in ring. I'm not talking about work rate here. We're not gonna get into that in every Hogan match, but just something where the pace gets picked up. Think of the guys he's faced for most of 85, Stud, Morocco, you know, and not just in the Garden, but all over the country. Not often he faces a guy like Savage who's you know, very quick and just knows his way around the ring just as much as Hogan does, but in a different way, and makes the match a little, you know, adds a little extra zip to it. And I wanted more. I actually would have taken time off the match next, which we'll talk about after the break.
So
I would have taken some time off.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. And then, Kelly, you can weigh in too.
Sure.
I think longer time would have hurt this. Like, I thought the way they did it was perfect. And this has kind of been the Hogan formula for the first match. And I don't know if this one goes three. I haven't looked ahead. But I kind of like the 10-minute sprint. He did it with Morocco, too, where it's just a hot brawl, no heat segment, no waste of time, just, you know, boom, 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 out. Like, I kind of like that formula here, Scott. So, I want to see these guys wrestle more. But I kind of think this worked. I think if they slowed it down, it could have maybe, you know, I think the match would have still been fine, but I thought this made both guys look really good, and it was just red, red hot.
Yeah, I wasn't looking for, like, 20 minutes. I would have taken maybe a minute or two, maybe split the difference of the next match, because I thought that match went too long. But, I mean, the meat and potatoes of the match is tremendous. And Savage just, he's understanding this crowd. I mean, he's obviously coming from spending a couple of years, you know, in the Mid-South Coliseum, which those crowds were fucking through the roof literally every night, every Monday night that Memphis wrestled. So he was used to kind of reading crowd reactions and kind of, you know, gauging energy. And that's exactly what he did here. I mean, Hogan got like, I mean, think of the things that are in this match that we haven't seen in a Hogan match yet. A ref bump, Hogan bleeding, post-match chaos. I mean, we hadn't seen any of those things in a Hogan match so far in 1980, not counting, obviously, WrestleMania, in a Hogan match at the Garden this year. So that proves two things. Number one, that Hogan needed to up his game a little bit, and he succeeded here. And B, that Savage is Savage. This is a guy who's going to have a huge 1986, no doubt about it. Because this match was painted differently, even differently than the three-match series with Morocco, and those three matches were really good. But Morocco, you could tell, was kind of like there. He wasn't really a threat for the title. You really didn't think he was going to win any of those matches or win the title in any of those matches. Savage is a guy you could look at and go, you know, he seems like the kind of guy that could just, you know, grab some tights or ref knockdown shenanigans. Obviously, it didn't happen, but he may be the first Hogan opponent of 1985, even more than Piper. And I know we had that debate, JR, when we did the Wrestling Classic show. But even more than Piper, I'll even say, there could have been a legit puncher's chance. You're like, well, holy shit. You know, it's New Year's week. As you said, JR, crowd's geeked. There's two big shows going on in the country. Who knew? In Savage's case, you just didn't know. That's what made him great, and that's why this match is great. What'd you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Scott, because Savage was undefeated, remember? Like, he was new to the territory in the summer, had never lost. Like, Morocco, the fans, had seen him lose before.
I was about to ask that. Had he been pinned at all yet?
No.
I mean, obviously he lost to
JRD
by count out, but...
Yeah,
maybe on a house show, on televised house show, but I don't even think that. Because they were building up the Hogan matches for all the cities, right, to take that around. So, no, Savage was totally protected, was fresh. I think the fans totally thought a title change was possible. It was right after Christmas, just like when Backlund lost to the Sheik. So, you know, history might have repeated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crowd's on their feet this whole match. They're really invested in this. They totally buy it as a contender, as a threat. But anyway, yeah, to the match. I mean, I love this match. I've seen it numerous times before. Spoiler alert, yes, it does go three at MSG. So this, I think, was the perfect first chapter. It totally leaves the crowd wanting more. You get Hogan busted and bloody at the end. He gets his heat back and gets some redemption, but Savage takes the title, puts it around his waist, parades around, gets the victory, a count-out victory still, but it played into the whole story of the match. And like JR said, like, Savage was he underestimated Hogan. He thought, you know, he's better than him. Then he realized, no, actually Hogan's the real deal. So in the end, he kind of wanted that count-out victory just to escape, because he knew Hogan kicked out of the elbow. Nobody had kicked out of the flying elbow before, probably, and at least not on a big stage. And Savage knew it wasn't his night, you know, best to just, you know, go dirty, get the count out, win.
Break a piece off.
Yeah. Exactly. Leave them bloody. Like, that's mm-hmm. great. And live to fight another day. This was super cool. I want to get into Al Hayes a bit here. He basically buried the whole history of wrestling at the beginning by stating all the champions before Hogan pale in comparison, or pale in significance to all of the champions.
Every single one.
That was one of the
best Stan burials. Stasiak. Everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
Total one sentence burial of like 100 plus years of history, wrestling history. I think Al was, I don't know about his drinking habits during shows. I don't know if he has this reputation, but I don't know if you guys felt this too, but I kind of felt like Lord Al was maybe a little intoxicated during this show. I'm not sure. I'm just there was a lot of, he mixed up words quite often. There's some slurring at times later on. I know he's dead now. I don't want to make any wild accusations, but I just kind of thought maybe it was just a tinge on the drunk side during this card, but maybe not. Maybe that's just Al.
It's the holiday season, Kelly. Give the guy a break.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He was getting a good head start on New Year's.
He was
Eve.
Having some eggnog, and he didn't know somebody, slipped it in.
No, it was the first time I ever really thought about that for Lord Al. Was that I think he was drunk tonight, but maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, this match, like Hogan, the clothesline in the corner spot. By Hogan, that's one of my favorite Hogan spots, and it was done really awesome here, where then he backed off and did like a macho sort of trademark sort of burn there. It was great. Him catching Savage off the top rope was like an awesome display of strength that, Hogan, of course, he's a strong guy, but he didn't usually do like the typical strongman spots like press slams and stuff like that. So that was impressive to see Hogan do that. Just catch him like that. Elizabeth, when he picked up Elizabeth on the outside, that got a huge pop from the crowd. Everything was just so well done in this. Both guys, they were just on the same page. Like immediately, these guys were great together and would be for many years to come. I really like this match. I gave it 3.5 stars as well. I thought this was like a quintessential Hogan spectacle match. Like this is definitely one for the highlight reel, for Hogan's highlight reel, and for Savage's highlight reel as well. This series, it's maybe, I've made the claim before that this is my favorite Hogan feud or series, these three matches at MSG, and we're off to a great start here.
Man, they really struck gold in Savage. It was like, what a find, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing that they snagged him before. I mean, how dumb is Vern? I mean, there's a guy that probably could have tore up the AWA, and they had that relationship at the time. But, he was an idiot.
I
wouldn't
have gone there if I was Savage.
I know. Well, exactly. Oh, of course, absolutely.
I'm going to make money. Like, I'm not going there.
Exactly.
I think Savage knew how good he was, and, I think he probably saw that. He could be a pretty big star in New York. I think that,
Oh, yeah. No, if New York calls you, you take that call and you go there.
No, there's no doubt. Yeah, there's no doubt. All right, why don't we take a break as we are past the midway point with this championship match. JR, thumbs up, middle?
This match was really, really good. Other than that, yeah, solid.
Kelly, good so far?
Yeah, better than the previous two shows that I joined you guys for, I think, halfway through.
Yeah, this is definitely better than that debacle last month.
Oh, God.
All right, why don't we take a break? And yeah, definitely.
Even without Hogan Savage.
Yeah, when we return, we have four matches left, including midgets and hillbillies. But first, in many words, none of them hillbilly or midget, because I'm on my eighth summer, still hot, young's the eighth wonder. All I do is get bread, yeah, I take one of your chicks straight from under your armpit. The black Brad Pitt, I'm at till 6 in the a.m. Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do.
Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA on-demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Hey, this is the King of the Mountain, Jeff Jarrett, the founder and president of Global Force Wrestling, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
We are back talking the December 30th, 1985, Madison Square Garden House Show. Myself, Scott, Kelly, here with you as always. And guys, so not only are we going to wrap things up for 1985, we're also going to, at the end of the show, give our Match of the Year award out for, you know, the best match that we watched here in 1985. So stay tuned for that, of course. That's still to come. And, you know, Scott, I've given my thoughts. Kelly's given his thoughts. Say you, Scott. Say you. And then say I'll say me. And that's what and Lionel Richie was saying on this day in December of 1985. I feel like I could have set that up better. I kind of stumbled into it. But here we go.
That's all right.
Why don't you tell us about what's going on in your pop culture corner here this week
to close out
the year.
To close out the year, of course, JR's talking about Say You, Say Me, Lionel and his nice little...
Jose Luis Rivera's wife is cheating.
Yes. Say you, cuckold him. Obviously, this movie White Knights, which we talked about on the last show.
God, no more White Knights. I'm done with White Knights.
Because there's not one, there's two songs from that out from that shit movie in this
guy.
This song
dominated the back end of 1985. Fucking White Knights.
Fucking Mikhail Baryshnikov. Because Say You, Say Me by Lionel was number one this week on the Billboard. It came out the previous Saturday, the 28th. And it is also from White Knights. And another song, which we already know about, is in it later in the countdown. And number two, we're going to talk a lot about this song, JR, in the beginning of 1986. One of the first actor/non-singer forays into the pop world. Because we want to not just party. Want to party all the time. Eddie Murphy. Who, of course, is on Top of the World. He was, of course, the funniest guy in a dark time on Saturday Night Live. He had two of the greatest comedy films of all time, both Raw and Delirious at this time. And now he thought he could dive into singing. Of course, he had great movies as well. So Party All the Time is at number two, and it's going to keep moving. At number three, a song I don't really remember that much, Alive and Kicking by Simple Minds. Never even remember that movie. At number four, the song that, God, I remember singing in eighth grade. 2 years later. That's What Friends Are For, Dion. Yes, we were singing the Five Satins. Little That's What Friends Are For, Dion and Friends. Those friends were, I believe, Elton John. And I can't remember the other one was. I almost said Mark Ingram, but I meant James Ingram.
By the way, I have a awful memory of that song, like seared into my mind. It was my sister's nursery school graduation, I think.
What?
So that would have been 1989-ish, probably. And I was sick. I was homesick from school. But I had, no one to watch me, so I had to go with them to this graduation. And I was in the fucking nursery school bathroom puking. And they were doing, a video montage, of pictures with that song. And all I could hear was that fucking That's What Friends That. So whenever I hear that song, I immediately go back to my head in the toilet in that nursery school bathroom as, that video was playing. It's just, one of those memories from childhood that has burned into my brain whenever I hear that song.
Oh my
god! It's like A Clockwork Orange or something.
Yeah, I think he wishes he had his eyelids held open by clamps. And oh my god, yeah, yep. I sang it 2 years earlier as my eighth grade song. I'm trying to think: Dionne Warwick, Elton John. I think the other one was James Ingram. Anyway, at number five, "I Miss You" by Climax, KLYMAXX, Climax. At number six, "Small Town" by John Mellencamp. Number seven, Broken Wings, these broken wings. And Kelly, the Blue Jays have broken wings. At number eight, Separate Lives, the other song from the movie White Knight. JR, maybe we should do a live watch of the movie White Knights.
See, Separate Lives works better because there's the White Knight on the message board also has the side where he's just a meek pussy, and then online he's this big internet tough guy. So Separate Lives.
At number nine, Tonight She Comes by The Cars. And then number 10.
So that's not by Climax, Tonight She Comes? That's what Johnny Rods was saying to Jose Luis Rivera when he pinned him in the ring. Tonight She Comes, buddy.
She's in the hot tub with his wife. And at number 10, I don't even know this song, Election Day by Arcadia. I don't even know the hell Arcadia is. So there's your top 10. For the week beginning December 28th, 1985. And as a matter of fact, JR, I think we're going to be doing the next week's countdown the following Saturday. Mm-hmm. So, all right, let us go to movies now, and we will, shall we say, wrap up the 1985 year of movies. And after we do this, JR, I'll have to take a look. Maybe I'll do it. I'll do it on our next show. I'll recap the 1985 movies. On our next vault when I talk about the beginning of 1986. So we're going to put Christmas Day and New Year's Eve together because two movies came out Christmas Day and three movies came out on New Year's Eve. So I'll do them in order.
It's your world,
five
buddy.
Of them.
You do what you want.
Two movies made no money.
White Knights.
White Knights. White Knights 2.
That's
right. The Rivera
Rush to see it.
Yeah. Here's a comedy. a comedy that made no money called Bombs Away. And, of course, it did. It bombed away because it made no money.
Let's see what Bombs Away is about. I don't even see it. It's not even Wikipedia. It's so it didn't even make that. That's how bad it is.
It's not even worth it. Not even worth it. So there you go. The other movie that made no money. Speaking of Jose Luis Rivera's wife and Climax. The movie is called Street Walkin'.
Mm. Sounds like my kind of movie. Let's see here.
Starting Jay Arsenio D'Amato.
Street Walking. One word.
Yeah, Street Walkin'. With an apostrophe.
Street walk in. Excuse me. All right, hang on. Let me see. I didn't realize it was slang talk.
Yeah, cutting it slang here.
That doesn't have one either. If it's one word, it's not a.
Interesting. I think I remember this movie though. It's like, you know, it's about a typical thing. You know, small time girl. It's kind of like the video "Fallen Angel" by fucking Poison. That's pretty much what the movie is. All right, so those two are stinkers. Next, this movie made $346,761. It is a drama called Revolution. And no, not the Shane Douglas led faction in 2000 WCW. Not that Revolution.
Right, let's see here. Revolution. There's a lot of entries under Revolution, as you expect. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
A 1985 British historical drama film directed by Hugh Hudson, written by Robert Dillon, starring Al Pacino, Donald Sutherland, and Natasha Kinski, or Kinski, sorry, I was thinking of Gene.
Natasha Kinski.
The film stars Pacino as a New York fur trapper who involuntarily gets enrolled in the Revolutionary Forces during the Revolutionary War. Revolution received a great deal of negative reviews upon its release. It was a box office bomb. His release was delayed in Pacino's native New York City. Due to disappointment, Pacino took a four-year hiatus until 1989's Sea of Love. Dexter Fletcher, Sid Owen, John Plowright, Dave King, Steve Berkoff, John Wells, Annie Lennox, Jesse Birdsall, Graham Greene.
Annie Lennox from the Eurythmics? Annie Lennox? I don't know if she was in a movie.
Robbie Coltrane. Yeah, looks like that. Annie Lennox, yep.
Wow, that's weird.
Walking on Broken Glass, was that her?
Yep. Well, I never saw she was in it. Never knew she was in a movie.
She probably never was in another one because this one fucking sucks so bad.
Yeah, it did. All right, number two is a movie that actually I know very well. I remember it being out. I think I remember it on HBO, too. A romantic comedy. It made $30,762,621. It is called Murphy's Romance. Pretty well-known actors in it, too.
Let's find out. A 1985 rom-com directed by Martin Ritt. Film stars Sally Field, James Garner, Brian Kerwin, and Corey Haim. Yep. The film's theme song, Love for the Last Time, performed by Carole King. Emma Moriarty is a 33-year-old divorced mother who moves to a rural Arizona town to make a living by training and boarding horses. She becomes friends with the town's druggist, pharmacist, Murphy Jones, but a romance between the two seems unlikely due to Murphy's age and because Emma allows her ex-husband, Bobby Jack Moriarty, to move back in with her and the 12-year-old son, Jake. See, Carole King is Tilly. Dennis Berkley, Georgianne Johnson, Dortha Duckworth, Michael Crabtree before he became a football player. Charles Lane, Anna Levine, John C. Beecher. That's about it. There you go.
Yep. All right. And your number one movie of the weekend, and this kind of is weird and also seems very, shall we say, foreboding considering what would happen the following month. But the number one movie of the last week of December was a documentary that made $125,900,000. It was called The Dream is Alive. I remember this documentary very well because it's only 37 minutes. I remember watching it in school.
It's an IMAX movie. They had IMAX back then?
Yeah, I was kind of stunned by that as well. I saw it on a VHS tape, but it was... Yeah.
A little bit different of a...
yeah. We definitely got downgraded. Yeah, we got downgraded on that
19-inch TV versus the fucking IMAX theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Movie was released in June of 1985 about NASA's space shuttle program, narrated by Walter Cronkite. Scenes from numerous shuttle missions, beginning with the dawn landing of Discovery at Kennedy Space Center, and on from there.
I noticed that today on Wikipedia. I don't know why it said maybe they re-released it in December because it says it came out in June, which I thought was kind of strange. But so anyway, there is your final five movies of 1985, and on our next Vault JR, when I do the first weekend of 1986 in movies, I will recap who made the most, and I have a feeling there's a couple of nominees and a little Rocky IV action.
Nominees.
Back to the. I think the number one movie will probably be Back to the Future. I don't think there's any question, but we'll see. All right. let's go to sports. And JR, you were exceptional. Yes.
I had a great 85. I don't know about you guys.
You had a great you had a great 1985. And we are in the wild card round. Let's go through the final standings real quick. The final standings in let me find them. Let me see here. Let me find the there we go. Here are the final standings of the 1985 NFL season. In the AFC East, the Miami Dolphins won the division at 12-4. The New York Jets 11-5. The New England Patriots 11-5. Both made wild cards. The Indianapolis Colts 5-11, and the Buffalo Bills 2-14.
Rex is gonna turn that ship around, Buffalo.
That's right. In the AFC Central, the Cleveland Browns 8-8. The Cincinnati Bengals and the Pittsburgh Steelers 7-9, and the Houston Oilers 5-11. Tells you how fucking atrocious that division was. In the AFC West, the Los Angeles Raiders win it at 12-4. The Denver Broncos, went 11-5. This was, I think, Elway's like third year, and they didn't make the playoffs.
That's right. Yeah.
Yep. Seattle Seahawks and the San Diego Chargers 8-8, and the Kansas City Chiefs 6-10. In the NFC, the Dallas Cowboys won the NFC East at 10-6. It ended up being a three-way tie with the Giants and the Redskins, but the Cowboys won all the tiebreakers. So the Cowboys won the division. The Eagles finished 7-9, serves them right. And the St. Louis Cardinals, 5-11. In the NFC Central, no doubt here, Pete's guys, the Chicago Bears, 15-1. No doubt about that. Gave up a NFL record low 198 points in 16 games. Pretty impressive. Green Bay Packers, 8-8. Minnesota Vikings and Detroit Lions, 7-9. And the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at 2-14.
Yeah, in the NFC game West, we fucking got. I tripped up on.
Yes, the LA Rams won the NFC West at 11-5. San Francisco 49ers 10-6. The defending world champions Niners slumped to 10-6. The New Orleans Saints 5-11, and Chadley's pitiful Atlanta Falcons at 4-12. So this past weekend, Saturday the 28th, Sunday the 29th was wild card weekend. On Saturday, at the Meadowlands, little JR, even 5 years old, or 5 years old, little JR,
just turned
pumped
five.
Up about
all
his
pumped up.
That's right. You were all pumped up about your beloved Jets. Sadly, season came to a crashing end, as they do to you now. I mean, back then, the New England Patriots crushed your hopes and dreams with a 26-14 victory.
What a never-ending nightmare.
Tony Eason, 12 of 16, 179 yards. I don't know how they won
we'll
all these
have
games. Fucking sucked. Ken O'Brien was 13. I guess he got hurt because Ken O'Brien was 13 of 17 for 149 yards, touchdown and a pick. And then Pat Ryan was 10 of 17 for 84 yards, touchdown and a pick. Freeman McNeil was held. Yep. Freeman McNeil was Patty Ice. Freeman McNeil was held as Patty Ice. 16 carries for 41 yards. So the Jets struggled offensively.
The Falcons had Patty Ice in the Super Bowl. They wouldn't have blown that fucking 30-point lead.
That's true. That is absolutely quite true. And the next day, the NFC wildcard game from from the Meadowlands. So actually, Giant Stadium was busy that day. They had a game on Saturday and a game on Sunday. Sadly, the results a little better for Mr. Flanagan and Mr. Dr. G's New York Football Giants, who defeated the San Francisco 49ers 17-3.
Yes.
So there was your NFL wild card games that weekend. So there you go. All right. In college football, it was bowl season. There were four bowl games on this weekend. Friday the 27th. I believe that was the Liberty Bowl. I don't have names. I just have the city, so I kind of remember. The Liberty Bowl in Memphis, Baylor beat number 12 LSU 21-7. Then on Saturday, three games, the Aloha Bowl from Honolulu, 15th-ranked Alabama beat USC 24-3. At the Sun Bowl in El Paso, Georgia and Arizona, another shit team for that Chad roots for, Georgia and Arizona play to a 13-13 tie. Couldn't even beat Arizona. How good was Arizona in the 80s, for God's sakes? And in the Citrus Bowl in Orlando, 17th-ranked Ohio State beat number 9 BYU 10-7. The your AP top 10 in college basketball, the final poll of the year, of the calendar year. Of course, we're halfway through the season. 1 through 10 was North Carolina, Michigan, Duke, Syracuse, Kansas, Georgia Tech, Oklahoma, LSU, Memphis, and St. John's. One game in the NHL on this night, and it was out in L.A., the Kings beat the Jets 4-2. There was nine games in the NBA. The big game of note, Alex English had 42 points. The Nuggets at home beat the Rockets 125-122. The Celtics beat the Clippers 125-103. And the Nets beat the Knicks 123-111. That's amongst some of the other games that went on that evening. Your division leaders at this point, Celtics led the Atlantic 23-7. The Bucks led the Central 22-12. Rockets led the Midwest at 20-12, and the Lakers led the Pacific at 25-5. And finally, this didn't happen on this day, JR, but the next day, guys, the last major celebrity death in 1985. Remember one of the great shows of the 50s when television first became popular? The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. Well, one of their kids ended up being a pretty well-known singer, and that was Ricky Nelson. Mm. He died on New Year's Eve, 1985, at the age of 45 in a plane crash. So that was the sad celebrity death to conclude the calendar year of 1985. Ricky Nelson died at the age of 45 from in a plane crash over DeKalb, Texas. And that is your final pop culture report for the calendar year.
Way to kill the vibe. Thanks.
1985.
Buzzkill.
There you go. Everybody have
died
a great
in a plane crash at age 49.
Ricky Nelson's dead. All right.
MSG.
MSG, where he actually had a very memorable concert in 1973.
That's right. Yeah.
The song Garden Party, remember? Well, you don't remember Kelly.
Yes, I used it for my defunct At the Garden podcast as the intro song, actually.
That's right. Yeah, great song. All right, back to the Garden we go. And one of the two guys in this match, JR, we heard from earlier on in the evening and now is in the ring taking on one of our stalwarts of 1985 here at the Garden. What do we got?
That is Big John Studd taking on Mr. Junior, Mr. Wonderful Superstar, Tony Atlas. Big power matchup on tap here. Studd is finally away from the Andre stuff. Studd shoves Atlas into the corner off of the opening lockup and then does it again. Atlas recovers and grabs a side headlock, but Studd drops him with a shoulder block on a charge. Atlas gets rocked on another shoulder block, so then he cracked him with a headbutt instead. Studd bails to recover and comes back in and breaks Atlas down with a test of strength. Studd controls that for a bit and then goes to a wrist lock. Atlas fights to his feet and goes to the arm as Gorilla wonders if Tony can press slam Studd. Tony gets a sunset flip for two but turns into a Studd side headlock. Atlas escapes and leapfrogs and gets a crossbody for two before grabbing the arm. Studd goes to the eyes but Atlas blocks a punch and gets a sloppy atomic drop. The crowd fires up Atlas as he stalks Studd, who bails outside again. Studd takes his time and then climbs back inside and grabs a bear hug. Atlas wiggles free and gets his own bear hug as Studd is trying to hang on. Studd comes back with hard blows and goes back to the bear hug. Atlas punches free, but Gorilla chastises him for wasting time until he finally comes at Studd and slugs him down. Atlas gets a running elbow drop and jumping headbutt for two. Studd keeps his cool and clubs away and then dodges across body block, drops an elbow, and gets the win. Sluggish meandering here. Just a few good spots and nothing else going on. Studd chugs along with another win into 86. I went half star in this blah, blah, blah. Kelly, what do you think?
Yeah, it wasn't much. Some nice spots by Atlas. I like the sunset flip. Like, that was impressive, actually, on Big John Studd. The leapfrog was impressive, too. Crossbody. The crowd was hot at the beginning. Monsoon and Haste eventually get around to talking about Japan, and then Giant Baba's name is dropped. Which was kind of cool. Also, it's cool because WWF had the connection with New Japan and not All Japan, so Baba was rarely ever referenced on WWF TV.
Everyone's in the Christmas mood, Kelly. Everyone's in the mood.
Yes, yeah.
Good tidings.
Yeah. Everybody gets pimped. The bear hug led to boring chants, as was the
norm at the time in MSG. And at times it was good, but it was mostly dull. I gave it 1 star.
I gave it a half a star. This was my least favorite match of the night. It was way too long. Tony Atlas sucks, except for that sunset flip was impressive. Otherwise, he's just terrible. And Stud didn't do Stud any favors. I like the way you said it one time, Jerry, like the Stud side headlock. Like that was the actual name of the move.
Might as well be.
Time for the Stud side headlock. Stud was not given any favors here. Tony Atlas just not good. Great physique, incredible body, but just has zero wrestling ability. And I mean, a sunset flip was a nice athletic move. It doesn't help otherwise. It was pretty bad. And that's what I was saying, JR. I mean, I would have given like another minute and a half to Hogan Savage and just knocked this one down to like 10 minutes and given the other one like maybe 11 minutes. That's all. I was 12-15 for Stud against a guy that's just as lumbering as he is just not good. Not good at all. And it didn't do anybody any favors. I'm still a big Stud guy, but that just did no favors to him. Tony Atlas is. I gotta honestly be. I'm curious what you guys think. I really do think that the way that the company's kind of building right now, I feel like Tony Atlas has kind of outlived his usefulness in this company. Like, there's more athletic, better baby faces, and I feel he's kind of outlived his usefulness. He's not a good promo cutter. And obviously, this new era, the new Federation era that Vince is building, Tony Atlas just doesn't fit. I don't know, Kelly. What do you think at this stage?
Other than the body, like he had still the great look.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That Vince loves. But yeah, no, it's true. I mean, he was never part of any angles or feuds or programs or anything. He was just like you said, meandering around. Hanging on. Of course, his drug issues are well documented at the time. Part of the reason why he wasn't really entrusted to anything that required any kind of reliability from him to be around for a program or anything. So, yeah, he was kind of just playing out the string at this point, for sure, because he would last into about mid-86. I think he left just as I was getting into watching full-time, basically. Because I don't remember Atlas being on TV at all.
I was just there cashing checks to put that money in his clock and buy that cellophone.
Yeah.
Yes. So, there you go. Big John Studd gets the
clock
win.
Where the hell did he hide the money? Was it under his bed?
It was under his bed.
That's where it was. I hide it here, sure. I don't spend it. I hide it for myself.
Get
me a cell phone. We need to. If we can find that, we should live watch that fucking thing sometime. That was the Life one, right?
Yeah, the MTV one with what was it? It was Triple H in China, Atlas, and
Speedy Delivery Rory Fox, or whatever his name was. Wasn't that one?
Oh yeah, I think it's on YouTube actually. What the fuck was his name?
Special Delivery. Was it Special Delivery? Rory Fox. Was it
Rory Fox. Fox something like that. Something like that. Yeah. But yeah, that was the Tony Atlas and his slumping fucking promotion that was dying. So so Stud gets the win in 12-15. All right. Next up, a match, believe it or not, that I actually liked, at least comparatively speaking with other matches involving midgets. JR, lead us in. What do we got?
You said you like this match? I can't believe it. We have a big match between Butch Cassidy and the Haiti Kid. And yes, it is a midget match. Our buddy Jeff Jarvis tried to find some background. Okay, I don't know if you have any, but Haiti Kid was Raymond Kessler, born in New York, 1954, born with dwarfism, but this did not prevent him from pursuing his career in wrestling. Made his debut in 1972 under the name Haiti Kid. Wrestled throughout North America, numerous promotions, including Stampede, AWA, Championship Wrestling from Florida, Portland, and MACW. Most widely known for his appearances in 86 and 87 with WWF. It is believed his final year of wrestling was in 1993 in Puerto Rico. Conflicting stories on the internet whether he's even alive. Some say he died in May 4th, 2011. These reports have been refuted, saying he's alive in New York, still ticking in New York. Kelly, any info on the Haiti Kid?
I don't have any info on his current whereabouts, but yeah, he had a long career. Like you mentioned, all the different territories, he was well traveled. But the midgets, of course, they were like the women. They went from territory to territory all year long, so they logged a lot of miles. He was not too bad. He was very fast. Like he was one of the faster midgets that I've seen. And he very memorable stuff coming up where he gets involved with Junkyard Dog as his partner, and then with Terry Funk and that whole disturbing angle with Funk branding him. And he definitely had his moment in the sun coming up in 1986.
And yes, it was rapid delivery of Roy Fox. He was the guy in the other documentary.
Yeah, documentary. We'll have to take a look. We'll have to look for that.
It's I found it here. It's on YouTube. Well, actually, it's maybe pulled off. We'll just see. True Life. I'm a pro wrestler and I want to be a pro wrestler. Apparently, there were two of them.
Interesting. So there you go. We'll have to take a look at that.
All right. His opponent, Butch Cassidy. All you know is his real name is Steve Eisenhower, and his hometown was Knoxville, Tennessee. Anything on this guy, Kelly? Butch?
No, not a thing.
All right. A match featuring two great midget wrestlers, as the announcement says. Haiti Kid checks in at 99 pounds. A little year-end treat for us. Gorilla puts over Butch's bill and says 20 more pounds will be out of a job. It'll be too big. And he was pretty cut. I'll say that. He had a pretty good look. Alfred and Gorilla gush about loving midget matches. Kid looks to be wearing slippers or aqua shoes or something as we get the usual midget fare in the match. They mix in some solid offense and trickery with the near falls. I thought the match was way too long. Kill's time has zero purpose to be here. I know what the reasoning behind having the midgets on the card is. That doesn't mean I care for it. I think it was maybe just too long. Kid finally grabs the win. Standard stuff. I gave it a star just for the effort and because they put on a decent show. But whatever. I can never get into this stuff. Mainly, I think because I'm never a fan of like exhibition type stuff. Like I just like matches because usually they have some kind of direction or meaning. Like there's no midget division, there's no title on the line. Like it just means nothing to me. So like I just have a hard time getting into it, knowing it's not going to be any follow up. It's not going anywhere. These guys aren't sticking around really. There's nothing. There's no reason to have this match. So I've always had a trouble with matches like that where there's no continuity behind it. At least even like a fucking jobber match to open the show. Like at least it's something. At least you can say those guys are on the cards regularly. They're doing something. They may be going somewhere. Matches like this just are complete. Like I'd rather just have an intermission, and it's not no slight on the midget division themselves. Just my issue with matches that lead to nowhere. So there you go. Take that, Butch Cassidy. What'd you think, Scott?
This is actually one of my one of the better midget matches that I've enjoyed. That's why I gave it a half star instead of a dud, like I give every other midget match that I've ever reviewed. The only thing I'm going to say is, yes, it did have the usual dopey, you know, midget gimmicks in midget matches. You know, the referee throwing the guy back on the pin and little running around with Haiti Kid with his little shoes and, you know, really ref gags and that kind of stuff. But I feel like Butch Cassidy, because he was a little bigger and actually was kind of like built, kind of added a different dimension to it instead of a typical stupid little, you know, mice running around looking for cheese midget match. So I just, at least with Butch Cassidy, had like a guy with some build. So I liked that there was actually some kind of wrestling philosophy going on.
He was a good looking midget.
He was. I mean, if that gorilla said another inch or two, he wouldn't be a midget. He'd be just a short wrestler. A short wrestler in the regular division.
I'm surprised he didn't say, he's packed on 30 pounds since I lost.
Yeah. Well, but no, actually, it was the opposite. He goes, he kept saying the Haiti Kid, they said he weighed 99 pounds, Lord, and I think they're being a little generous. I think he's more like 80. And I think, Alfred, you're right, Kelly, had the drunken giggle going. I guess you're right. He kept calling him the High 80 Kid.
Yeah, the High 80.
The High 80 Kid. I think I agree with you, Kelly. I think he was bombed.
He was hammered.
But, yeah, I mean, this match, it's one of the better ones for me, so that's why I didn't give it a dud. It's still a midget match, nonetheless, but it wasn't as bad as some midget matches we've seen in the past. What about you, Kelly?
I mean, I agree with JR. It's if you've seen one midget match, you've seen them all. Although the tag midget matches are actually better. Those are a bit more entertaining, you know. This was, it wasn't much. Haiti Kid, yeah, pretty good. Fast, like I said. I like the roll up he did for the pin. That was really smooth. That's often something that's botched, actually. He did that really well. Monsoon and Hayes were nostalgic for past midget stars at the beginning. They went through all the names. But yeah, no, not much to it, and I gave it 1 star.
Very generous.
I guess so.
And 10:32 the time, which is probably about 5 minutes too long.
I was just sad that they didn't make a Butch Cassidy and the Haiti Kid.
Yeah, tag team. Yeah.
Not even a joke
right
about
there.
It.
Yeah, little tiny cowboy hat like Kurt Angle wore in 2001. All right, next up, the other half of our tag team split series, JR. Earlier on, we saw the Anvil taking on B. Brian Blair. Now, the other half, the high flyers of the two tag teams, and that is...
Bret Hart taking on Jim Brunzel and his beard. Great match on paper to get us back on track. Brunzel controls the action early, sending Hart flying with a hip toss. Hart comes back and grabs a tight side headlock, which he holds onto as Brunzel tries to break free by using the ropes. Brunzel finally gets free and takes hold of the arm, mixing up his offense while working the limb. Gorilla shits on the beard, but says it's working, as Brunzel is in full control, giving Hart no chance to find an opening. Hart finally buries a tight, hard knee to the gut and then drops a strong elbow to the back of the head. Bret lands a back elbow and another elbow drop for two and goes to a chin lock. Brunzel works free and sends Hart outside with a great drop kick, but Hart sprints back in, goes right back to the chin lock in a great spot. Bret bites Brunzel in the nose and then kicks him in the gut to block a comeback. Bret tries a wild charge, but Brunzel ducks him, and Bret gets tied up in the ropes in a hard bump. Brunzel bites Hart and gets an atomic drop for two, and then follows with a drop kick for another near fall. Hart comes back with a near fall and jaws at the ref, allowing Brunzel to roll him up for two. Hart clobbers Brunzel and lights him up with an uppercut, but Brunzel dodges another one and gets a backslide for the flash pin. Hart beats on Brunzel after the bell and leaves him hurting on the floor. That was really fun. I loved the finish, as both guys were dead even, and Hart got just a bit lazy for that split second, and Brunzel snuck in the win. That lucky beard paid off. This is a really good rivalry budding between these two teams. I like this a lot. And again, they were portrayed as being even, with Brunzel just narrowly eking out the win. So I went 2.5 stars on this one. What'd you think, Kelly?
Well, I mean, the crowd just wasn't into it at all. Like, they didn't show any respect to these guys. There's
a
lot of
boring
shit.
They just watched like a 30-minute midget match. So
and these guys didn't have, you know, that much status at the time. The Killer Bees were relatively new. The Hearts had just started. Well, they'd been teaming for, I don't know, 6 or so months, but you know, they hadn't accomplished anything significant as a tag team yet. So the crowd didn't really see these guys as stars. So yeah, there was a lot of boring chants. And at first I thought, ooh, this could be like one of the worst Bret Hart matches I've ever seen. You know, it was kind of slow going. But yeah, it came around for sure. And they actually did win the crowd, which made me happy, because I love to see a match where the crowd is just totally indifferent to it at first and not into it, and then eventually gets lost in the match and is totally behind it. Brunzel's beard is a weird thing, because I don't think he had it for very long, just a couple months, because I know for sure by the time they do the actual tag team match between the two teams coming up at MSG, the beard's gone. It's basically like a playoff beard in hockey,
right?
That's considered a lucky charm deal, and being from the Midwest and then spending, you know, a lot of time in the AWA in Minnesota, you know, Brunzel's a good, you know, like hockey fan, I'm sure. Us Canadians, we look at Minnesota as being like, you know, an honorary member of Canada in a lot of ways, because it's very similar. If you've ever seen Fargo,
that's when it was a cool,
yeah, the
cool
North Stars,
team.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, great jerseys, one of the all-time best.
I agree 100%.
Yeah, the movie Fargo is pretty much the, you know, that's like the prairies in Canada. If you've seen Fargo, that's that's what it's like up here.
You betcha.
Totally.
I think he's a Gordon Bombay guy, Minnesota, one of Minnesota's, you know, strongest, greatest youth players ever.
Yeah. So it's
Minnesota Miracle Man. Go ahead.
Yeah, Miracle Man. from my Canadian perspective, seeing Brunzel with the beard, it was kind of funny. But yeah, and then Brunzell going over surprised me a little bit, but I guess I'm just used to, you know, Brett winning most of his matches. From his singles days, I forget, you know, his low status at this time. I went a star and a half, but I think you guys maybe talked me up to 2 stars, I believe. I don't know. I was maybe worn down by the stud match and then the midget match. And yeah, but, no, yeah. I mean, I'm one to, definitely judge a match based on the crowd heat. And if a match doesn't have good crowd heat, I tend to rank it lower or even enjoy it less. So that kind of explains my star and a half for it, is that the crowd for most of it wasn't into it. But no, they did get into it. So yeah, I'll give it 2 stars.
I actually really enjoyed this match. I gave it 3 stars. I thought it was really well done. Thought it was good back and forth. It's obvious that they picked the right pairs for these two, because it seems like Brunzell and Brett have much better chemistry than if they did the other combinations. And we were talking about, I don't know, maybe Gorilla was dipping into the flask as well, because at the beginning of the match, Brett talks, Gorilla's like, doesn't Brett seem very oily to you? Shouldn't the referee check? And I'm thinking to myself, how do you check someone as being too oily? You must go take a shower now. what was that? You're starting to kind of sway me, Kelly, because I think even was sipping a little joy juice.
Yeah, Vince, you know, was in the festive spirit, so he bought them a few bottles, and just, you know, things just went a little crazy this evening.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, they must have had a party backstage or something, because they're like, I think the referee should check and see how oily he is. What a mess. I thought that was good moves. I thought they definitely started a little slow, but I feel they definitely picked it up. 13:55, in my opinion, not a short length for them. I feel like it didn't seem that long for me. And Gorilla pretty much acknowledges that, like, Brett is like one of his favorite guys in this whole company. He always says it whenever Brett wrestles, heel or not. And Gorilla doesn't usually, I don't say break kayfabe, but he usually doesn't compliment heels that much. But he always says that Brett's one of his favorite guys in this company. So, and it shows, because this was a fantastic match. Brett's good heel, jaw jacking with the ref and with everybody at the beginning. I enjoyed it a lot. 3 stars for me, definitely. And that's 2 3-star matches for the night, or 3+ star matches for me on this night. So, and we wrap it up with. Actually, JR wishes we could just go to the awards now and just bypass this whole thing. But unfortunately, I had a weird feeling about this match. And I think in 1985 I did as well. For we conclude with a World Tag Team Championship match. And JR, in his eyes, the number 1,000 contenders for the titles, and most certainly not the number one contenders.
I am not white knighting for these challengers. The Dream Team taking on the Hillbilly Contingency, as Gorilla Monsoon likes to say. The Hillbilly Bush continues on as Jim and Uncle Elmer stomp to the ring for their big title shot. The Dream Team are still cool, locked in as champs. Crowd pops big for those fucking hillbillies, just like they always do. Good storytelling as Beefcake and Jim are matched up after the injury earlier in the year, and I like that they call back to that as well. Valentine kicks away at Jim to start things and grabs a side headlock, but Jim catches him with a bib boot and a headbutt to rattle him. Jim rams into Hammer and snapmares him down for 1. Jim grabs a headlock and tags in Elmer, who punches Hammer and then hoists him into the air with a chokehold. Hammer takes Elmer down and tags in Beefcake, who struts and then stomps away. Hammer tags back in and kicks away, and the champs keep quick tagging, doing what they can to keep Elmer grounded. Elmer fends them off long enough to tag, and Jim comes in and grabs a Beefcake, but Brutus works free. Elmer tags back in and slams Beefcake hard to the mat, and then drops a leg, but Hammer makes a save. Things break down as all 4 brawl in the ring until Johnny V hops up and baits Jim over. Elmer grabs Beef for a bear hug, but Hammer clobbers him from behind off the top for the win. Not terrible, I guess, which is surprising. It was kept short. The crowd loves those fucking hillbillies. Good enough energy. I thought the champs looked smart. They outworked and outwitted the bigger challengers. And not the worst match to end this card or end the year. I went star and a half on this, which is, for me, like going hillbillies is like 6 stars. So there you go.
Scott. I gave it a star. I hated it. I didn't like it at all. I thought the ending was okay. but I tell you something, though. It was mercifully quick, at least, 429. But in the building, obviously, you know, hindsight's 2020, but in the building, I think you maybe had that feeling. Like I said earlier, you know, Hogan's had the, you know, was bloodied up and, you know, Savage won the match. And you want to send the fans home happy? I don't know. I think Vince was one toke over the line, sweet Jesus, from booking the hillbillies to win the to be the world tag team champions. I swear to God, it just had that feeling in the air when the don't go messing with the gun. The place is going nuts, and he'll, you know, Uncle Elmer's waddling his fat ass out there, and you're thinking, holy fucking shit, this may actually happen. I think for a split second, if you're sitting in that crowd that night, you're thinking, holy crap.
Yeah.
And let me tell you something. It would have really killed me because Valentine and Beefcake, the interview earlier in the show, they were so fucking great. I mean, like, fucking Beefcake's in jeans and his tights. It's like so awesome. And, you know, Valentine in the awesome, like, Crockett-ish suit holding the belt. I mean, they're so awesome. They definitely should not have lost, and they didn't, thank God.
No, there's better challengers to come. I mean, there was...
No, there is, but still, though.
You can make an argument that you could have put the belts on the Hillbillies given how over they were. Like, I don't think it would have been the worst move. But, yeah, they had other teams lined up that they had to get to, and the Dream Team were rolling too much. I mean, I guess you could have maybe done, like, a quick switch and then right back. You know, like, had the Hillbillies win and the Dream Team win it right back in the next month or something just for the pop.
Yeah.
But the Hillbillies really didn't need the belts, I guess, to be over. They're already
No,
I mean, it just had that weird feeling, though. Like, you just didn't know. You just didn't know. But otherwise, it's, you know, it's what it is, and the Dream Team retains the titles. Kelly?
Yeah, I like this. I mean, it was the perfect length, 429 or whatever. You didn't want it to go too long with Hillbilly and Elmer, because you definitely would run into some pretty slow spots and boring spots with them. Yeah, this had, you know, I'll be a glasses half full guy on this match, because it had some positives. One was the length. One was Valentine. I mean, good God, what a test of his skills, having to carry not only his partner, but the team opposing him. So basically, Valentine and three broomsticks in this match.
Yeah,
pretty much. And you could tell he was the guy who kept it all together and was directing traffic. You know, this was a Valentine match. And another positive was the super believable near fall with Elmer on Beefcake, where, you know, he crushed him with a leg drop. Valentine was nowhere to be seen. It looked like it could conceivably have been a title switch at that point. And the crowd, like Scott mentioned, was definitely in their minds that this could be a title change. You know, why not? I mean, the tag belts changed usually two or three times a year. Wasn't unusual. So it could have happened, this evening. So yeah. I wasn't expecting too much going into this. Of course, with the team that the Dream Team were taking on, but no, they booked it very smartly, I thought, short and sweet, and I gave it 2 stars.
All right.
2 stars?
Right. Yeah, well, you know, different... Oh,
what if it was an 8-man and they had a junior and, well, I don't know if Cousin Luke debuted yet. What if all four of them wrestled barefoot? There you go.
Well, we know, Scott, you're prejudiced against country folks. So
no, Justin's prejudiced against.
Star. Hey, I gave him a star and a half. I gave him the.
He's prejudiced against country folk. I'm prejudiced against short people. Anyway, no. All right, so there you go. There's our card. Hot crowd and a good way to end 1985.
Sure.
So now, JR, for the final time in 1985, it's time for the awards.
Let's do it. Our match of the night, I think, is a no-brainer here, and that is Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage. Yep. You guys all agree?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say – well, yeah, in the general sense, no-brainer. But definitely, for me, honorable mention for Brett and Brunzel. I mean, they were fantastic. But no doubt on this night, just for everything involved, entertainment purposes, et cetera, definitely Hogan Savage.
Yeah, no-brainer, Hogan Savage. worst match of the night, our Cousin Junior Award. I'm going with SD Jones and Ron Shaw. Kelly, what'd you think?
Yep, I agree. Jones and Shaw.
Scott?
No, I am going with Stud and Atlas. Hated that match. I'm giving some love to Ron Shaw. That match was 11 minutes and 50 seconds too long. And Ron Shaw and SD Jones was only about 2 minutes too long for me compared to the Tony Atlas. I just hated it.
All right. So. MVP of the show, I went with Hulk Hogan. I thought even with Savage in there, I thought Hogan looked the best. I thought he worked his ass off, and I thought it was a really impressive showing for him as the top dog in the promotion. Who do you have, Scott?
I agree with you 100% because Savage is Savage. You're going to get that all the time. Hogan, like I said earlier, Hogan kind of got taken out of his comfort zone and had to be a little unpredictable, and normally he's not. More unpredictable than Johnny Rod's cuckolding Rivera's wife. But, Hogan definitely upped his game because he knew that the roster was changing, so he kind of had to change with the times. So I definitely give it to Hogan. Kelly?
I debated this one for a while between Hogan and Savage, and I went with Savage. But, I mean, yeah, Hogan is just as viable as a pick for MVP. But Savage, he just was so good in this, just doing all the great things that he does. This was his kind of match, and you know, this was his first main event at MSG on the big stage after years. You know, he was in an outlaw promotion with his father where he wouldn't get brought into any of the big territories because of that. And he had to kind of, you know, pay his dues for a longer time than a lot of guys had to, because he wasn't, he'd been in wrestling 4 or 5 years longer than Hogan, remember, you know, so it had been a long time coming, and here he is on the big stage finally, and he delivered big time. The crowd loves him, loves to hate him, totally buys him as a main eventer, totally buys him as a big star. So yeah, Savage is my pick.
All right, the guy who doesn't deliver and is the winner of the Gator Wolf Award for the worst worker of the night. This guy will always win probably when he's on these cards. For me, that is Uncle Elmer.
I'm gonna only because Uncle Elmer, we only had to deal with him for like half of that match. I'm giving it to Tony Atlas. He was just other than that.
Poor Tony Atlas.
He destroyed me tonight because. Being a big John Studd fan, I am. That was just the Drizzler, or now the Gator Wolf. It used to be the Drizzler, but he was pitiful. I hated him. Did not like him tonight at all. At least Uncle Elmer was hidden in half of a 4 minute match. You can't really hide him anywhere. Kelly,
I went with Elmer. Like I thought about it.
You're gonna say Ron Shaw, you heathen.
I thought it was giving it to Shaw, also being in the worst match. Yeah, I didn't really want to have to do that. Elmer was clear. Like, if you're just looking at all the guys and saying who has the least amount of wrestling talent, it's Uncle Elmer. I mean, it's he didn't do much this evening. So, yeah, he's my pick.
All right, best moment, I had Hogan chasing down Savage, bloodied Hogan chasing down Savage, going to get his title back, and then beating him up and posing. To me, that was the best, biggest pop and best moment of the night. What do you think, Kelly?
This was a tough one because it was definitely something from that match, the Hogan-Savage match. Like, I couldn't really decide, but I ended up going with Hogan catching Savage off the top rope. Like, that was... I don't know. For me, I thought that was super cool. The crowd like gasped and thought that was amazing. And yeah, I thought that was the peak moment in that match.
What do you think, Scott?
I'm going to have to disagree. I'm going to do a third one. The Tony Atlas John Studd match actually ending was my, no, I'm only kidding. No, I got to agree with you, JR. I think Hogan, cause I mean, how often do you see an angry Hogan bloodied up, his belt stolen? I mean, he just went crazy, and it was again a side of Hogan we needed to see. And the belt was like half on Savage, and chucks him in and starts beating him. It was pretty awesome. You never got. I mean, you kind of saw a crazed Hogan during the Morocco stuff, but not like this. Him, you know, skulking down the ramp or the aisle and grabbing his Savage and getting his belt back. Definitely the moment of the night for me.
All right, and our Junior Mr. Universe Award for the most juiced, I went with Hercules, Kelly.
So did I.
Scott?
Even though it's named after that piece of shit, Tony. No, just slam Tony Atlas anymore. No, I agree. Hercules was definitely looking pretty buff tonight, and bending Jose Luis Rivera in half kind of actually proved that point tonight. So
two in a row for Herc. If he wins another one, he may have to rename that award.
We have to name it the leather leather Lederhosen award.
Right, there you go. Lederhosen vehicle.
Lederhosen vehicle award.
All right. So final grade out of 10, I went 4, which is pretty standard. Like I'm around there usually on a lot of these house shows between 3 and 5-ish. You know, I thought this was fine. I didn't seem to like it as much as you did, Scott. I liked Hogan Savage a lot. I thought Brett Brunzell was pretty good. The crowd was into it, but we didn't have like that other anchor match that we've had a lot of times. Like Dream Team Hillbillies didn't get it done for me. We didn't have that, I don't know, that secondary one that was like really hot or quick sprint. To me, outside of Hogan and Savage, it was a lot of dead zone on the show. So I went with a 4.
I definitely liked it more than you. I'm going to give it a 6. I loved Hogan Savage, loved Brett Brunzell. I really actually really liked Poffo and Adonis.
I think you're drinking with Lord Al was drinking.
The commentary was great tonight. It was great listening to them. I love Gorilla and Alfred. I don't love them more than Gorilla and Jesse, but definitely more than Gorilla and Mean Gene. And they made every match entertaining. They attempted to do the best what they could with a couple of the stinkers, but I thought they did a great job, and I thought Savage was great. Hogan was fantastic. And, I overall enjoyed the show. I give it a 6. Kelly?
I went with 4.5. Yeah, like JR said, it didn't have that, you know, number 2 match. Like, for me, it was the first show I was with you guys. It was the Piper, Orton, and Andre Orndorff tag. Then you also had the Dream Team US Express tag. So those are two big ones. And I gave that one a 5, or that show a 5. And it was definitely better than the previous show I was on with you guys was the October show, which I believe, I think the highest ranked match I had was 2.5 stars on that one. There was no duds on this show for me or for any of us, I guess, right? No, we didn't give a single dud.
Nope,
yeah,
no,
that's rare.
Oh, I did. Yeah. Didn't I give the opener or no? I forget. Maybe not.
No, you gave it a 0.5-star.
Okay. Yeah, duds.
So, yeah, that's maybe the first MSG show to go dudless. So that's something. Because I've had shows where there was multiple duds.
And we had midgets and Jose Luis Rivera, and we had no... And
yeah,
we had
well, the midgets got, like, a pity star from me. I mean, I probably would have backed him with a dud, but it was a pity star.
No, that wasn't a dud. Like, it had crowd heat. Like, I can't give a match a dud that the crowd's into. That's just not fair. Like, they did something.
True.
So, yeah, a match has to be totally silent or, you know, like, go-away heat to get a dud. So, yeah, this show didn't have duds. 4.5. Yeah, I mean, the Hogan Savage match is an all-time classic, but there's nothing else I can really recommend to anybody on this show, unless you're a big fan of the Dream Team and want to see Valentine, you know, kind of pull off a minor miracle there. 4.5 sounds about right for me.
All right, so
there we go.
Now we're at the end of the year. I wanted to take a moment and talk about the best matches that we watched, guys. I think by pure grade-wise, if you go on Snowflakes, there's 2 that got double 4 stars for me and you, Scott, and that is the Tito Valentine series, the January match, and then the March match. We went 4 stars on both of those. I think that's the highest aggregate rating. I don't have it marked down what you had for that U.S. Express Dream Team from August. Me and Kelly both had it at 4 stars, so that might be a top 3 match as well. Sutton Wade.
Yeah, I give that 4 stars too.
Okay, so that's those 3 are probably the best matches overall. Sutton gave his vote. He thought Hart's Bulldogs was his choice for best match, and that was July. I went 3 on that. I'm not sure what you had it at, Scott, but and then
which
there's
one?
Also.
Oh yeah, I have to. Yeah, some of these. I gotta go back and double check my. I definitely graded that probably slightly less than you guys. So,
and then Orndorff Piper.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
I had that at 3.5. So, I mean, those are probably, you know, the top 5-ish in there. So I would say, is there any, Kelly, off the top of your head that you think we're missing from this? I mean, there was a good Steamboat Morocco, Scott, in November. You went 4. I went 3.5.
Hogan and Morocco had a couple pretty good ones. I mean, for me, my favorite match of the year would be War to Settle the Score, Hogan and Piper, just for all the bells and whistles, you know, all the pre-match stuff, all the post-match stuff, the heat for that, the feeling in MSG that night. Like, that's a match that I could watch any day and just, you know, I love it. It's one of my all-time favorites just as a pure spectacle. Was that one. What other matches? No, I think you guys covered them all. Maybe not. Are we just talking about MSG? Or are we going into
You can do all
Saturday night's main event?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, the main event for WrestleMania 1's also, of course, iconic match. The Saturday night's main event matches in 85 are all pretty short, you know? There's a lot of fun stuff, but they get, as Saturday night's main event goes on through the years, you get better matches and longer matches. But yeah, because I've watched all the 85 shows recently along with you guys, and I was kind of surprised at how short all the matches were and how, you know, you couldn't really say. I mean, there was another Piper Orndorff match on.
Right, that might
on,
be the best one, I think, so far.
Yeah, probably. The Hogan, I love the Hogan Andre versus Stud and Bundy tag. That was like a super fun match, but not a, you know, a classic or anything. So, yeah, 85's an interesting year because it was one of the all-time peak years for the company, right? First WrestleMania, MTV. All that Hogan on the cover of Sports Illustrated, all the popularity, the Rock and Roll, Jose Luis Rivera and his wife and all that. But yeah, so many stars, like so many great performers in the company. They were so deep talent wise. In 1985 too, but the nature of the territory, the nature of the promotion was, you know, the spectacle, the angles, the big main events, and not the work rate stuff, not the you know, you had the stuff with Tito and the IC belt early in the year, and Valentine was great all the way through the year, but it wasn't a priority to put on big time matches, so to speak, really, throughout 1985.
Any other learnings you want to talk about, Scott? You know, I think Hogan, watching him in 85, obviously, was really cool. You know, we've talked about some of the other stuff, like the Andre Heenan feud has been rolling on throughout the year. We saw that ate up a ton of time, all the colossal jostling and all that stuff. You know, I think that Santana Valentine was as good as advertised throughout the year. All their stuff. You know, I mean, there's been some cool stuff, like a lot of Piper was a lot of fun. So some unique stuff in there, like Fujinami showing up and the Cobra, you know, like all that kind of stuff in the middle of the year. So there's been a lot. It's been fun watching a lot of this evolve. It's, you know, the deepest I've ever gone into 1985, gave me a new appreciation for Mania 1. And I'm looking forward to head into 86 and see what continues.
I agree. I think a new appreciation for guys that I already liked, guys like Valentine, definitely a guy like Mike Rotundo, who we saw, you know, a different side of him and a different you know, more of him than I remembered, particularly solo stuff. I mean,
well,
the match with Sheik in April, that was one of was it April? Let me look. I mean, just to make sure. Yeah, April.
Was it April?
No, it was April.
Okay,
it was the same because we gave
it was
we had two
Carl,
three
right was that
yeah
was
we yeah. gave two we gave two three and a halves on that night because we each gave a three. Well, you gave it a three, but I gave Hogan Morocco 3.5. And just seeing like guys evolving and the announcing evolving, even the production quality of the show itself, the MSG Network and, you know, the music and Gorilla doing sponsorships and things like that. Like just seeing the evolving of television for Vince and how important it's going to be to the company going forward. That definitely is the big thing for me. And I'm looking forward to 1986 because we're going to see even more great characters come in and more great guys come in. And yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. But 1985, as you said, Kelly, was really a zenith year for them, coming out of nowhere. You know, Vince rolled the dice globally, and he's on his way. So can't argue that either. Maybe there was better quality Guy still in Crockett. I mean, don't forget, just a month earlier, we had Starrcade 85, which is one top to bottom, one of the greatest shows ever. And so Crockett had things that WWF didn't. They definitely did not have better announcers, because as I watched them on the network, listening to David Crockett announce is like nails on a chalkboard. He's a So I think I'd rather listen to Mean Gene, believe it or not. So yeah, JR, there's definitely seeing things evolve as we go through, definitely into 1986, and seeing, you know, things like television production and the little things like that, the little nuances grow, I think will be huge. And yeah, so there you go.
All right, why don't we wrap things up then with the bow on 1985. Scott, we'll be back next Monday, kicking off 86 with Saturday night's main event from January 4th. And then Kelly will be back with us in 2 weeks as we dive into the January 27th, 86 house show. Scott, we have a main event this week?
We do, yes. Tomorrow night we'll be recording, and we'll talk about some of the superstar shakeups and good or bad for either show or certain guys, and look a little bit ahead to Payback and stuff like that. So, yep,
we got,
definitely
we
this week.
Gonna tap anyone?
Mr. Greenhouse will be joining me again. Logan Crosland, who was at with you guys at WrestleMania,
he couldn't make the young boy.
Yep, couldn't make the make young. Look at a lot of young boys, and he wanted to make the recap episode, and he couldn't do it, so he cashed in his chip for this week. So, and we're hoping to get one more guy, but it'll be a good show. We'll talk a lot about, again, the shakeups and stuff going on right now. So
very good. We did that last week on Clotheslines and Headlines. If you haven't listened to that yet, we had Brandon Howard on from Fightful.com, talked a lot about the business end of WWE coming out of Mania, so it was very interesting. We talked a lot about the JBL stuff as well, so very good conversation there. If you haven't checked that out, please do. Also, I want to give a plug to our buddies at Our Vantage Point. Had a good interview with Sean Mooney last week, so that was a cool chat for them, and they're really excited about it. So it's getting good feedback. Be sure to check that out. And then also, I just want to give a little tease. If you were a fan of Letters from Kayfabe, just keep your eyes upon PlayStation.com later this week. That's all I'll say, but just titillating the listeners out there. So if you were a fan of that show and you want to hear more of that ilk, tune in.
There we go.
All right. We'll be back next week. Kelly, thank you for joining us as always. We'll talk to you
Pleasure, Kelly.
So. Yeah, thanks, guys.
And Scott, I'll talk to you. I'll see you Saturday, and then we'll talk next week as well.
Yep.
Fun as always. All right, for the crew, I'm Justin. We're out. Talk to you next week in 1986. Don't you be white knighting for 85, Scott.
Say you cuckold.
She turned 24, only been with one man. What happened to her plan? She was gonna be an actress. She was gonna be a star. She was gonna shake her ass on the hood of Whitesnake's car. Her yellow SUV is now the enemy. Looks at her average life and nothing.
and bring back Springsteen.